From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. And if you've made a donation this week, you're helping keep us on the air. Thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep the show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, an audacious claim of the Trump administration facilitating a two-state solution in Palestine raised eyebrows around the world and garnered applause from American evangelicals, particularly those who anticipate particular events in the region to usher in the second coming. That's right. You heard me. Fundamentalist Christians are cheering a Trump plan for resolving an endless conflict between Jewish and Muslim populations. What could possibly go wrong? Meanwhile, this week saw the Council of Europe blindsided with a culture war-style resolution declaring widespread so-called religious freedom protections that instead codified the right to discriminate in a wide range of circumstances with the claim of deeply held religious beliefs. Mercifully, the proposal was defeated. This time, once again, secular defenders of democracy were completely unprepared for a carefully crafted and organized attempt to fundamentally pervert the notion of religious freedom in the service of a far-right theocratic agenda. Let's never forget that the price of liberty is still, indeed, eternal vigilance. And the Reverend Raphael Warnock, the senior pastor at Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, declared a run for the U.S. Senate from Georgia. The influential activist, who has been on this show a number of times, stated, quote, "I've always thought that my impact doesn't stop at the church door." That's actually where it starts. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Unborn children have never had a stronger defender in the White House. They are coming after me because I am fighting for you, and we are fighting for those who have no voice, and we will win because we know how to win.
For opponents of reproductive rights in this country, the annual March for Life is like Christmas and Carnival at the same time. The political religious right festival of slogans and ad hominem attacks on any American who dares not hew to the life begins a week before conception rhetoric that has become gospel for this passionate constituency has never drawn a sitting U.S. president. Until now. But there Donald Trump was, pandering to the part of his base most useful in a time of impeachment. Religion News Service writer Jack Jenkins was there last weekend, and we'll get his first-person observations later on this week's show.
I think this is ending very, very well, as we see that evangelicals support President Trump at an all-time historical high. The base is stronger than ever. 99%, the latest PRR, say the impeachment is absolutely ridiculous.
We've gotten used to the truth that no group of Americans supports this administration more fervently than white evangelical Christians. While there can be no doubt that the kind of conflation of religion and politics we've seen is bad for both, a more detailed look at the growing divide within the broader evangelical community recently appeared at BuzzFeed News that deserves our attention. The headline reads, "Anti-Trump Evangelicals Are Trying to Figure Out What to Do Next," and reporter Emma O'Connor will be here with details. But first,
basically, the White House convinced the Supreme Court that Ban 3.0 wasn't anti-Muslim since it allowed anyone in, regardless of their race or creed or Muslimishness, as long as they applied for a waiver. Unfortunately, the White House's robust waiver process is a fraud. For the first 5 months, waivers were issued at a rate of just 2%.
It's been 3 years since the Trump administration issued its unconscionable Muslim travel ban. An estimated 135 million people are affected, and even worse, in recent weeks, there have been warnings of up to seven more nations being added to the list any day now. What a way to mark an anniversary. At the forefront of public education on this issue, as well as calling for comprehensive legislative action, is the nonprofit Muslim Advocates. As Congress now seems finally poised to take some action on what's called the No Ban Act, I am so pleased to be joined by the organization's special counsel for anti-Muslim bigotry, Madeha Hassan. Madeha, thank you for being with us. It's great to have you on State of Belief Radio again. I am so proud of what your organization is doing.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the incredible support. We've known you for years, and it's always been incredible to have your allyship and partnership. So thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today.
You're very welcome. A terrible symptom of this age of information overload is that no issue seems to hold the public's attention for more than a day at most. Something awful happens, hand-wringing and head-shaking ensues, and then public attention shifts to the next outrage or crisis. For the many millions affected by the Trump Muslim ban, we're 3 years into almost unimaginable disruption and damage. So would you talk about all of those harms that we are experiencing, please?
Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right that, you know, this day and age, we're operating in a time where there is some new breaking news moment almost every day. And old news comes really quickly. So in the 3 years that you pointed out so eloquently since President Trump's Muslim ban went into effect, countless families have been needlessly separated. People have been denied access to life-saving medical treatments. Children have been denied their parents and grandparents. And people have missed the births, deaths, weddings, and funerals of loved ones. We have also seen religious scholars unable to frequent gatherings and congregations that they are regularly, normally, or expected to attend as they have been in the past. We have seen people that have been essentially what we would say is in limbo, waiting for answers about whether they were going to get to see their family members. There's also what we know that one of the reasons why the Supreme Court upheld the Muslim ban initially was because there is what we call a waiver process. But that process, which would actually allow people the possibility of entering the country is essentially a sham. And many, many people have been just waiting and waiting for the answers that they need to determine whether they're going to be reunited with their families and be able to get the, as I said, the urgent medical care or so on and so forth. And so this has been tormenting families, and it has been just another one of the many challenges that our communities have faced in the wake of this administration taking office.
Madiha, we just passed the third anniversary of the original ban, and there have been warnings of an extreme expansion of this outrageous policy. How much worse does the White House want to make this?
That's a really important question. You know, we have heard rumors that there will be a possible expansion of the ban, as you said, Reverend Gadding, to include seven additional countries. What's important to note about those countries, keeping in mind that that list could change because nothing has been officially announced yet, but it's important to keep in mind that one of the things that, you know, we have been very clear about, that this is a Muslim ban, and this will continue to be a Muslim ban. And one of the things that we believe will happen is, you know, it's important to keep in mind that there are already multiple countries on this list. So if we are expanding that list, this is just going to exponentially increase the number of families and individuals that have been impacted by this policy. It's also important to note that many of the countries that have been circulating around in the press as possible additions to the list are African majority countries as well as Muslim majority countries. So, you know, that will also be an important opportunity for other organizations and groups that are working on immigration issues affecting those countries. You know, it'll be another opportunity for us to partner with them and hopefully provide resources to them, because we know what kind of damage this can do. And I don't think that this will result in the same type of frenzy that we saw at the airports after the first iteration of the Muslim ban, because many of us are better situated to be able to respond to this and prepare for what can come. But we do know that the harm will be just as difficult for families and just as impactful.
Is it even possible to predict a timeline for an expansion?
We thought that this might be announced actually this week because of the anniversary. Many of us were preparing for the possibility that it would come at the time of the anniversary or near it. We are now on Thursday of this week, and so far it hasn't been announced, but it's hard to predict. We know that there are many other things happening in the country and in the world that may be drawing the attention of the White House and others, and so it hasn't happened yet. But we are prepared, and we are doing everything we can to get our resources ready so that as soon as that announcement is made, that we are able to be a resource to the community and those individuals that may be impacted by this. And we also are prepared to stand alongside our partners who have been vocal about their condemnation of the ban, and we expect and hope to be able to call on our allies to do just the same as soon as the announcement is made.
Muslim advocates, along with many partner organizations, including Interfaith Alliance, have been relentlessly lobbying for passage of the No Ban Act. Talk about that proposal, if you would.
Absolutely. Thank you for raising that. So the No Ban Act, which actually stands for the National Origin-Based Anti-Discrimination for Non-Immigrants Act, easily called the No Ban Act, is a bill that was introduced in April of last year. And what's really important about this bill is that it was crafted as a direct response to the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the ban, because that decision was in large part made on this idea that the President of the United States has executive authority to act under the Immigration and Nationality Act to restrict entry into this country for a particular class of individuals. Now, the reason why that's important is because what the Supreme Court was saying when they made that decision was that the President acted within his authority when he signed the Muslim ban into law. So the bill actually does something which will, what we call is sort of close the loopholes that executive authority has right now. So it would actually change or amend the INA, which is the Immigration and Nationality Act, to include language that would prevent religious discrimination in restricting entry into this country. So that doesn't only affect the current versions of the Muslim ban, but it also would make it very difficult for any president to do something like this in the future. And that's why this is so important, is that we aren't just talking about repealing all three versions of the current ban. Any potential future ban would also be covered by this bill. The other thing that this does is it increases restrictions on presidential authority to do this type of thing. So requires more scrutiny, seeks out more standards in presidential action. And it would also repeal the asylum ban that's currently in place, as well as remove any heightened or what we call extreme vetting for refugees currently trying to enter this country. So this is a very comprehensive bill, and it was crafted with the intention of being a direct response to the Supreme Court decision. And we believe this is really one of the best vehicles that we have to respond to this issue of the Muslim ban.
Madiha, I hope you will not mind me asking you a question that is somewhat personal, because I'm thinking of this. I think about it a lot when I think of you and all of the friends that I have at Muslim Advocates and Muslims around the world. What is it like working where you work and dealing with an issue that could immediately, if passed, make your life more difficult and cause you to see people that you love and want to be with and want to be enjoying life have all of that taken out from under them? How do you get up in the morning and face that kind of challenge every day?
Well, thank you for asking such an important question. And I think many of us that are doing this work really do have to, you know, find things that inspire us and find moments that we can see as, even if they're small victories, but to see as victories to keep us moving forward. And I think one of the things that has been really incredible is to be able to have so many interfaith partners and so many allies across the country that have stood with us. When we heard the announcement of the first version of the Muslim ban, I had so many friends and family members and just even acquaintances and law school classmates reach out to me and say, you know, if there's anything that we can do to help you as you do your work, please let us know. And I think that was something that was really just an incredible moment. We saw tons and tons of people go to the airports to express solidarity and to help the people that were impacted by this discriminatory policy. And I think that is what keeps us going. And that is what really, I believe, is going to get us to the finish line on this. And whether it's the bill, the No Ban Act, that's going to be the solution, is going to be because of the great work of our partners and our allies that have really gotten us through to this point. And I think that the same thing will happen if another ban or if another expansion is announced. And I know that we'll all be ready to challenge this as best as we can.
Well, it's a critical time for public engagement. You all have made good plans. You've put out good material. What do listeners need to do to help with the No Ban Act?
Yes, that's a wonderful question. And we are at a very critical point, as you said, Reverend Gaddy. We are very, very close to what we call a markup and a vote on the bill in the House of Representatives. And that is historic in and of itself, because this bill speaks directly to the rights of American Muslims. So we need people to contact their members of Congress and make sure that they will vote to pass the No Ban Act. There is plenty of information about this on our website, which is at www.muslimadvocates.org. We encourage you to check that out. Look at the list of representatives that have still yet to co-sponsor the bill. Contact their office if they are your representatives and ask them to co-sponsor the bill and to make sure that they will vote yes on passing the bill, because as soon as we make it through the House of Representatives successfully, we will then need to shift our attention to the Senate, and that we know is going to be even a more challenging effort. And so we are ready to move to that next step, but we need to get through the House first.
Please say again why it's so important to take action on this right now.
This bill is just about weeks away from a markup and a vote in the House of Representatives. And as soon as we are able to contact our members of Congress, urging them to vote yes on this bill, the sooner we'll be able to get one step closer to repealing the Muslim ban that has been affecting countless families for over 3 years now.
Madiha, how can listeners keep up on this issue, and how can we support the work of Muslim advocates?
Our website is www.muslimadvocates.org, and we have all of our information is available on our website about this particular effort, as well as our social media. We have a Facebook page, an Instagram page. We are also active on Twitter, and the handle for all of those is just Muslim Advocates, and you can find us on social media. And please just amplify the work that we are doing. As I mentioned before, if we are going to have an expansion of the Muslim ban, we are ready to stand with our partners and be a resource. So we're going to be preparing fact sheets, and we're going to have those fact sheets available in multiple languages. And so do what you can to amplify our work so that it may benefit someone else that might actually be directly impacted by this policy. And please don't hesitate to reach out to us if you have any questions or if you'd like to get more involved.
Madiha Ahusain is Special Counsel for Anti-Muslim Bigotry at Muslim Advocates, working so that all people can live free from bigotry and discrimination. Madiha, you all do such great work. Thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Stay with us. Religion News Service national reporter Jack Jenkins will be here with a first-person report from the March for Life. And later, anti-Trump evangelicals are trying to figure out what to do next. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The March for Life is a mass gathering against reproductive rights that annually brings together the stars of the political religious right. And this year, for the first time, featured a sitting U.S. president. Jack Jenkins, national reporter at Religion News Service, was also there, and I am happy to have him join us now with his eyewitness impressions. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
The crowd estimates have been ridiculously all over the place. Do you have a sense of the turnout this last weekend?
Well, I wouldn't pretend to be able to give you an exact number, but I can tell you this is the second year that I've been sent down to the mall to cover the March for Life in person, and it was significantly larger this year than it was the year before. I think there's a few different factors that may have impacted that. For instance, one, that the president was speaking, but also that it was decent weather by comparison to the year before, where it was much colder and there was, still ice about. I think all of that played a role, but it was not a small gathering, to be sure.
Do you think the event is growing year to year?
I don't know if it's growing year to year. That's the question that I was asking some people in the crowd myself. I was inquiring about people who had attended multiple times. You know, did they think that this event or even movement was growing? And they would point to, you know, that event in January as having, you know, been bigger than the year before, but, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of uniform agreement that the event itself was necessarily larger. Now, I will say that there is something to the fact that the Trump White House has been clearly very invested in the event itself, right? Like last year, Vice President Pence spoke, and This year we did have Trump there. And those will up numbers in general in the same way that it kind of creates a rally vibe at this event. And that was very clear. There was no shortage of Make America Great Again regalia, and, you know, whether it was hats or shirts or signs, there was a lot of overlap between the Trump campaign message and the message that was being lifted up by many of the participants there. So I think that might also, if there's a melding of the anti-abortion movement and Trumpism, it seems to be the nexus of it seems to be the March for Life.
Yeah. I can remember that the days these happened when I was there, and it was people gathered all around the Capitol building, and I was thinking then it's not going to get any larger than that, but it may well be getting larger than that. What was the general mood of the participants in this year's March for Life?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people, particularly those who seemed excited to see President Trump, you know, there was kind of a jubilant mode in the sense they kind of felt like that Trump had kept his promises. You know, many people would kind of cite the idea that Trump was the quote-unquote most pro-life president ever. Now, that's a disputed characterization, but it is, regardless, there did seem to be an overlap between, you know, fandom of Trump and, you know, attaching that to the pro-life movement, quote unquote. And I will note that, like, you know, there was also kind of elements of whimsy. I mean, when you get crowds this large, you'll there's like more creativity in terms of the signs they make. Like Baby Yoda showed up in a few different signs, things like that. And it definitely gave you the sense that this was a group that felt empowered by comparison to previous years. Mm-hmm. Trump's administration, they do feel, and participants did say they felt, had more of their viewpoints at heart. Now, it is interesting. Folks were quick to kind of say that they would support Democrats that were anti-abortion in general as well. And I also note that a lot of the groups that come to the March for Life come with schools. So like Catholic and evangelical religious schools often send delegations, whether that's colleges or even high schools, and you'll see them walking around their respective banners. So that's kind of like a built-in element to the audience at the March for Life. But in addition to that, I do think that there definitely seem to be some resounding support for the president in general and his agenda, so far as it overlapped with the anti-abortion agenda.
Well, it certainly feels like a real watershed moment in the culture wars. How much stronger the devotion of the anti-choice religious right to Donald Trump became on that day?
Yeah, I think that there's a subtext for all of this, right? Which is that the President Trump has made a very clear effort in the last month and a half, in particular, to try to bolster support among evangelical Christian supporters and just conservative Christians in general, be they Catholic or mainline or otherwise. And his actual speech at the march was peppered with religious references, you know, referring to the dignity and the sanctity of every human life, you know, saying that when he sees an image of the baby in the womb, he's glimpsing the majesty of God's creation. He even thanked anti-abortion activists for, quote-unquote, you know, making their life's mission to help spread God's grace. I mean, these were terms that he wasn't necessarily using when he ran for president in 2016, but he's clearly, you know, dropping strategically. And this just comes a few weeks after he also spoke at a church in Florida to a group of evangelicals, launching his new Evangelicals for Trump initiative. And actually the same day as the March for Life, he launched a new initiative that's anti-abortion as part of his campaign. And you could see people carrying Trump campaign signs that were anti-abortion. So there's this whole subtext for all of it that Trump is hoping to capitalize and do exactly what you said, which is try to build up loyalty among his base, among conservative Christians. Now, part of this may also be in reaction to the Christianity Today editorial from late last year, where the editor of Christianity Today, you know, called for Trump's removal of office. And while that might not represent a particularly large group of people among evangelical Christians in the United States, Trump didn't really win the Electoral College by too many votes in 2016. So his margin for error this go-round is pretty small. And so I think there's definitely an element to which his campaign and the GOP would very much like him to bolster his support in these areas.
Jack, did you hear plans for expanded activism around reproductive rights springboarding from the March for Life?
I do know that it's certainly that folks who are fighting for reproductive rights have not slowed down as a response to this. I think if anything, you know, it's interesting to kind of see the March for Life be this large event this go round, because a lot of reproductive justice advocates have been really kind of active in the last year, particularly in response to state-level legislation that would further restrict abortion and access to abortion for many. And so I don't see that slowing down or going away anytime soon. I do think there's kind of a yin and yang here, where when, you know, the anti-abortion activists do kind of have a groundswell of support, so too do reproductive rights activists. So I do know there was some activism around the march itself, but I imagine that they're more concerned about, and my impression given the activism this last year, is that strategically those groups are more concerned about laws that are getting passed or from their perspective, hopefully not getting passed at the state level.
You've been doing a remarkable job keeping track of the religion outreach various Democratic presidential candidates have been performing. I believe the latest is Elizabeth Warren.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that, please.
Yeah. So Senator Warren just this past week had unveiled her new Interfaith Council. And this is a council of faith leaders pulled from different parts of the country that is specifically designed to both act as surrogates for her on the campaign trail and to advise her on policy issues that may touch on people of faith, which is a different metric and group of policy proposals, I would imagine, in a progressive space than it would be in a conservative space. Now, her campaign has also announced that they plan to have an additional 100 faith leaders endorse her publicly in the coming days. And some of those voices include, you know, progressive religious voices. The former moderator of the Presbyterian Church USA is one of the folks who endorsed Warren. And so this is a very clear play to try to, you know, occupy that faith space. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to read into that. I mean, this is a group of people, you know, it's a diverse group of people that, you know, everything from mainline Protestants to Sikhs to Muslims to historically black Protestants in parts of Iowa and South Carolina that are up for grabs. And I think a lot of the different candidates are hoping to kind of cut in to those demographics with these initiatives. And that certainly seemed to be the case with Warren. But she's following initiatives that have been launched by others. I mean, Biden has had a dedicated faith outreach director in the state of South Carolina specifically since last August, and he had 100 different faith leaders just in that state endorse him in the last year. And so, you know, some people for some of these candidates, they may be playing catch up to candidates who kind of got ahead of this faith, you know, outreach game early on.
Pete Buttigieg was probably the first to really bring the language of faith to his campaign. How central is that to his message? I know he met recently with Moral Monday's founder, the Reverend William Barber. Where is he? Is he really into this?
Well, I think one of the fascinating stories about Pete Buttigieg is that he's certainly not the only candidate to talk about faith, and he might not have even been the first. Cory Booker used to talk about it quite a bit, too. But Pete Buttigieg has arguably risen in large part because of his faith speech. He really early on in his campaign, he did a town hall with CNN, and when he made a comparison between the kind of faith that he espouses, which he said was more akin to feeding the hungry and welcoming the stranger, and that of Mike Pence, who he accused of propping up what he called the porn star presidency of Donald Trump, you know, that line had such a strong reaction. It catapulted him into the national scene within a day, and then he kept pushing on that and even referring to the religious left as something that he wanted, you know, to see a renewal of, a blossoming of, as it were, in around his campaign. So then he was also the only candidate to have a national faith outreach director. And that individual, Shauna Foster, actually used to be on the steering committee for the Poor People's Campaign, which of course is the major faith-led activist initiative led by Liz Theo Harris, Reverend Liz Theo Harris, and Reverend William Barber. Mm-hmm. So for him, this faith message has been truly key to him both reaching activists as well as, more recently, even some conservative voices who like that he talks, and more moderate voters in places like Iowa who like that he can kind of talk about faith saliently. Now, and like you said, he did go visit Barber's church relatively recently, and in addition to that, he actually showed up at one of William Barber's protests last summer when the Poor People's Campaign actually had a protest outside the White House, and Buttigieg basically showed up unannounced by himself, just with his staff, and did not speak, but just sat silently in the crowd the entire time, and, you know, did speak with William Barber a bit, but this seems like to have been a long-term strategy on the part of his campaign to attach themselves to more progressive faith activists like William Barber.
As you look at the whole field of candidates, do you see a change here, a recognition of the significant percentage of Democrats who are people of faith, or who at least recognizes the importance of religion in our pluralistic society?
Right. I do think there does seem to be a reawakening, or at least a newfound comfort with, you know, talking about faith in the public sphere among Democrats this go round. Now, that's not to say that the candidates haven't talked about it in the past. Barack Obama was actually, you know, had one of the largest faith outreach teams in modern Democratic history when he ran for president in 2008. And, you know, Hillary Clinton did, you know, frequently reference Methodist sayings, you know, do all the good that you can, as much as you can, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's not that other Democrats haven't, but it's rare to see this many candidates talk this often about it compared to previous election cycles. Now, you know, it looks different among different candidates, right? So, for instance, Bernie Sanders and Michael Bloomberg have now both spoken very passionately about, you know, their Judaism and Jewish values. Bernie Sanders spoke significantly less about that in 2016, but he has dug into that. His campaign even tweeted out a video of it recently, kind of talking about, you know, how he's proud of his Judaism and Jewish values and what that means. And you know, Michael Bloomberg even kind of like compared Trump to Pharaoh recently in one of his speeches. And then, of course, you have and that's in addition to Sanders having significant outreach to Muslim voters in the past and in the present as well. And now Biden apparently even has Catholic nuns writing letters to Catholics in Dubuque, Iowa, a heavily Catholic city, hoping to court that demographic. And so for me, that seems both, you know, a cultural shift among Democrats, which I think is partly a result of the fact that people of faith played such a significant role in the resistance protest movement after the rise of Trump, and also just partly a strategic recognition that faith outreach can make a difference. It might not give you the campaign an election all by itself, but when you're running, you know, 14, 15 Democrats all at the same time, the small little margins that you can eke out can make a big difference on election day or caucus day.
Well, and the question that I was going to ask you next was, is it making a difference? In other words, is it growing because it's working, or more because it's an honest expression of the values some of the candidates are bringing to the race?
Well, I think the elections expert Elections experts would say, you know, the only way to truly know the answer to that question is on an election day, right? Which we haven't had one of those yet. So we'll wait to see, in the concrete way whether that's been the case. But I will say that I think one could make an argument that Pete Buttigieg's candidacy in general is proof that there is something here, right? Mm-hmm. That he, having leaned into this and found it as a successful way to court attention and to repeatedly mentioning faith and the religious left in his press attendances, like repeatedly mentioning, you know, religious arguments, like referring to climate change as quote unquote a form of sin. These are things that he has strategically done, and it did elevate him as much as anything else in his campaign did, to making him one of the four front runners in this this cycle. So I think, you know, that's in addition to other folks who it didn't work as well for, but I do think you could make the case no matter what, that that there is certainly an element to which Democrats talking about faith gets them attention with voters. Whether or not that means they'll show up on election day, I guess we'll find out for the first time next Monday when we have the Iowa caucus.
Has anything else recently at the intersection of political campaigning and public religion caught your journalistic eye?
Well, there's certainly some stories I'm working on that I'll tell you about in the coming days when I publish those stories. but I think what is interesting is kind of the increasing power of these faith-based activists. I mean, not only did Pete Buttigieg visit Barber's Church, he's not the only one to do so. Tom Steyer, the billionaire climate activist, also did so, and both of them mentioned the Poor People's Campaign from the debate stage in this last Democratic debate. Barber also spoke at the Democratic National Committee meeting this past summer. And then that's in addition to him speaking at the Democratic National Convention in 2016. And what you're starting to see is that these faith-based activists, not just Barber but several others, are starting to be the kinds of folks that, you know, whisper in the ears or have very public meetings with Democratic candidates. And that's relatively new, that they're occupying these spaces of influence in the Democratic Party. And I think, you know, just the Poor People's Campaign on its own, the fact that you have major presidential candidates for the Democratic Party, you know, attending their events, showing up to their protests. I mean, that's not inconsequential, and that seems to be a marked shift from where the religious left was often dismissed as anemic or inconsequential in past years. It seems to be a force to be reckoned with among Democrats now.
Jack, I enjoy so much hearing you talk about what you see, because I know that you look very closely at all of this. In fact, if you weren't so busy, I would certainly encourage you to write a book. And yet then I find out you've just written the book. I know that we're still a couple of months out from publication, but I wish you would tell us a little bit about it.
Yes. So the book is called American Prophets. And it is the religious roots of progressive politics and the ongoing fight for the soul of the country. And it chronicles the rise of this new religious left. It helps give some historical context for where it came from, but it specifically looks at this modern iteration of religious progressivism and how it is influencing politics. It tracks several different major movements that have bubbled up to really kind of have a marked impact in both this election cycle and in Democratic politics in general. It also traces hidden stories that folks haven't heard necessarily. For instance, the role of the religious left, in the key role of the religious left in passing the Affordable Care Act, and also kind of the hidden role that it played in Barack Obama's candidacy, his political career, and in the 2016 election as well. And so if you're interested in the religious left in general and kind of wanting to see what this amorphous, very diverse, very complex group of people are and where they come from, that's basically what my book is about.
Now, you don't have to pass your book through the White House, right?
I don't think so.
Well, American Prophets is already available for pre-order, isn't that right?
That is absolutely correct. And anyone who wants to do so, I would encourage you to.
Jack Jenkins is the prolific national reporter at Religion News Service. His book, American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country, is due out April 21st. Jack, thank you so much for being with us again. If not before, we'll definitely have you back on to talk about the book once we get close to that publication date. It's always great to have you with us, and thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The headline was attention-getting. Anti-Trump evangelicals are trying to figure out what to do next. The fact that the article appeared at BuzzFeed News made it even more interesting, and I am happy to welcome the author, Emma O'Connor. Emma, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
A lot of more progressive people of faith could be excused at this point for viewing the political religious right as a menacing theocratic monolith, the ultimate outcome of white evangelical support for this president can't be predicted. But the divisiveness evident in recent weeks is already a big deal. Emma, you start with two prominent publications staking out positions on Donald Trump. Not everybody listening knows about those, so let's begin with you summarizing what happened, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, even though it was right before Christmas, when a lot of people, especially people who pay attention to Evangelical Magazine, are tuning out of the news and not really paying attention, like this controversy really caused a lot of outrage. Partially because it caused Trump himself to tweet a lot of angry things in his classic style. But basically what happened was the Evangelical Magazine Christianity Today, which was founded by Reverend Billy Graham and has been known as the preeminent evangelical magazine for a very long time, its editor-in-chief, Mark Galli, wrote an editorial called Trump Should Be Removed from Office. He basically argued that Trump should either be impeached or voted out of office because his argument was mainly around impeachment. He was saying that Trump had clearly committed high crimes and misdemeanors. He'd clearly acted inappropriately. He clearly was behaving ungodly. And therefore, whether it was through impeachment or through voting, he should no longer be in office. Galli actually, this was, I think, one of the last things he did before retiring, which was planned. It was not a result of the article, I believe, which I think a lot of people have said on the internet. but he was he knew that this was sort of his last hurrah. It sparked huge outrage in the community. A lot of people responded. There were 200 leaders who sent a letter to Christianity Today saying that they disagreed with this thesis. As I said before, Trump went on one of his Twitter tirades and called Christianity Today a far left magazine, which is a big stretch, I would say, if not just outright untrue. And what I wrote about was the Christian Post, which has, up until this point, had not really taken a stand. They are kind of a more, they're a newer evangelical-aimed magazine, online news outlet. They are more aimed online than Christianity Today. And the senior managing editor, John Grano, and executive editor, Richard Land, wrote a editorial in response to Christianity Today's article, saying, disagreeing, calling Galli an elitist, that his article was condescending. They called it, I have the quote right here, disdainful, dismissive, elitist posture toward their fellow Christians may well do far more long-term damage to American Christianity and its witness than any current presidential support, so any support for President Trump.
How much deeper do you think this split goes?
I think it's really deep, actually. I think a lot of people make the mistake of thinking of evangelical voters as a monolith. A lot of people make the mistake of seeing them all as white conservatives, when in fact you look outside of that demographic, the numbers go from about mid-70s, 75% support, depending on the poll, to 40% opposition, mm-hmm. which is a really big shift that's actually almost split. And so Nap Nasworth, who I write about in my piece, who works at the Christian Post and resigned over the editorial because he did not want the Christian Post to take this stance. And he really disagreed. Not, he was okay with it being published as an op-ed, but he did not want to work as an editor for an outlet that would take this very pro-Trump stance. Mm-hmm. So he resigned the day that the editorial was sent to him to edit. And he actually has written articles about how split the evangelical voters are on Trump and how saying that they are just this huge voting base is actually inaccurate. And a lot of people feel really conflicted. And a lot of the people that I spoke with and a lot of the people who've analyzed how voters feel about this feel really conflicted about Trump, because even though he might be pushing legislation or talking about pushing legislation that is relevant to their interests and sounds really great to them, they look at his behavior, they look at his policies on immigration, and they look at his past and the way that he speaks, and it just doesn't reflect the kind of leader that they have been raised to support. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, it really is a lot more complicated than a lot of places and people make it seem when they talk about this voting base.
We often see partisan views in our culture as immovably entrenched at this point. Do you see what's happening in the evangelical community as something new, or is this more a case of a split that's been growing for a long time?
I think from the people that I've spoken with who are much more knowledgeable about the evangelical community than I am, as sort of a newcomer to this topic, I've only been writing about religion exclusively for about a year. Before that, I was writing about more social issues and reproductive issues and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the people that I have been speaking to see it as sort of a split that has existed for a long time that is now coming to a head. It's a split between political evangelicals, I think is the phrase that I've heard. So people who are evangelicals for the purpose of pushing their political agenda. And I think a lot of people that I've spoken to question their faith and question their commitment to the church. Like Trump and the people that Trump has surrounded himself with, I think they're referring to.
Yeah.
So it's that group of people and the people who are putting those priorities over the morality and godliness mm-hmm. That they have been taught their whole lives. I personally, as I said, I'm very new to this, but that seems to be a common take among the people that I've spoken to who themselves are often anti-Trump, admittedly.
I'm trying to figure out how significant dissent in that community is in very practical terms. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do have some numbers. I went into it a little bit in my article, but there was definitely more information than I could put there. I worked with Paul Juppe and Ryan Burge at Denison University and East Illinois University, respectively. They're both political scientists who worked specifically on the religious right and also evangelical voters in general, and they helped me crunch some numbers about this. So it's the while the support, so they saw that the support of a white self-identified evangelicals is around 75%, according to the Cooperative Congressional Election Study from Harvard. But when you look at non-white evangelicals, that number drops to 33% approving of Trump. And the lowest approval rating is among Black evangelicals at around 11%, mm-hmm. Which is very low. And it's low among the Latinx community as well. it's higher than among Black evangelicals, but it's still below half. And that's something that I think that Trump is aware of, because he, after the Christianity Today editorial came out, he immediately announced that he was going to launch an Evangelicals for Trump coalition and rally, and he planned this rally really quickly, it seemed, at a very prominent Latinx evangelical church in Miami. And it seems like he's really kind of upping his campaigning toward that community, because he knows that the community that goes to a church with people who probably support Trump, but they themselves do not, is one that I think he feels that he could gather their votes. He feels like they don't have another option to vote for. So even if they're not enthusiastic about him, he could turn their heads.
I didn't realize that BuzzFeed News had a reporter on the religion and politics beat. And I'm very happy to learn that you're there. And I would appreciate you talking for a moment about the work that you're doing there.
Absolutely. So beats at BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed's a very unique news outlet. I think a lot of our beats are pretty nebulous. So while I call myself the religion and politics reporter, and that is a lot of the people that I talk to are associated with that realm, and it is a lot of the articles I work on, I also continue to write about Roe v. Wade, which I covered almost exclusively. I covered reproductive rights for the past 3 years, as well as other issues that are typically considered women's issues, quote unquote. And so I continue to cover that. Later today, I'm actually going to Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, their hearing in New York. So
good for you.
I cover a lot of different things. But on the religion beat, so far, I'm interested in major communities. I've written a bit about Knights of Columbus, for example, who are very influential in many communities across the country. And even though it is our readers are not members of Knights of Columbus, generally speaking, a lot of them have family members who are. A lot of them remember the Knights from their parishes growing up as the people who would serve them pancakes at breakfast. So yeah. Our readers who, as I think you can presume from hearing the name BuzzFeed, are generally younger, are still interested because it's part of their family. It's something that they can bring up and talk about with their family at Thanksgiving. And I think that applies for my beat in general. That's why our readers are interested in it, because even if, generally speaking, and you can look at polls saying this, young people in the U.S. are less directly affiliated with organized religion, it's still a part of their lives. It was still a part of how they were raised, and it's still a part of their family. So they're interested in reading my articles, I hope, for that reason.
You know, I think mainstream news outlets often don't take religious themes nearly seriously enough. And at a time when so many stories have a faith component, you've got a lot of work to do. And I'm wondering, what are the biggest challenges that you run into in the reporting that you focus on?
That's a good question. I think one of the biggest challenges is kind of the premise of your question, that people see BuzzFeed News, they understand who we are to some extent, and question my motives. I think BuzzFeed News has a reputation that I don't think is entirely accurate. I think we are very diligent and fair reporters who focus really hard on that. But understandably, that's not how a lot of people, especially in the faith community and especially in, I do focus a lot on the religious right in that community, think of us. So I think it's hard for me sometimes to gain the trust and understanding of the people I would like to speak to for these articles, but I have accomplished that, I think, in many ways. I think my writing and my reporting speaks for itself, and it's been helping me with that challenge.
Emma O'Connor is politics and religion reporter at BuzzFeed News. You'll find a number of valuable stories under her byline, and that's only going to become even more true as the battle over reproductive rights heats up in this country. Emma, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio, and I hope that you will keep up the good work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one other person. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You never know what's coming next. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.